I want to thank everyone who has taken part so far in the service. John for the PowerPoint, and Tom for the prayer, and Tom for the welcome, Sandy for the prayer, and Blue for the time of silence. That's great. About an hour ago, I was walking to Dunkin' Donuts, and I didn't know it was this cold out. And I had like a sweatshirt on, and it was freezing outside. It was blistering cold. And I was thinking to myself, here I am about to do a sermon that's really about Easter, which is like spring and tulips and all that stuff, and it's freezing outside. On the way back, I ran into these two kids who were probably sixth grade age. What is that, like 10 or something? It's like 12, right? And I had actually seen them the night we had Swan, and that night they were looking for someone to sell them pot and looking for us to buy them cigarettes. And this kid's like 11 or 12 years old. So as I was, you know, they came up to me and like, "Hey, I remember you. Will you buy me cigarettes?" I'm like, "No, I don't think so. Sorry." And then they called me a bunch of dirty names and asked the next guy who came along. And then he said something even dirtier to them, which I'm not going to repeat. But as I was thinking about it, I was thinking to myself, that's why I'm preaching a sermon about Easter. Because the risen Jesus has something to say to everyone. And we need to carry that to those kids. In case you don't know, my name is Matt Agresti. I'm not supposed to be up here. Christian, obviously, is supposed to be up here preaching. They're, you know, in the hospital having a baby. A few weeks ago, he told me, "Hey, can you, like, prepare something just in case I have to miss a sermon?" So I said, "Yeah, sure." And, you know, I mean, she's early, like 2 weeks early or something. So, you know, it happens. Luckily, last night, my wife Amanda and I went over to Christian and Michelle's house, and we were hanging out with them, and we were talking about, Christian and I were talking about what the sermons are going to be about. And essentially, we're talking about Easter until Easter, and we'll talk about Easter on Easter also. Last year, we talked about the last words of Christ before he was crucified and dead. This year, we're kind of flip-flopping it and talking about Easter and what Jesus' resurrection means for us today. I was thinking about Easter, just about what people think it means. And I was thinking when I was growing up, what I thought Easter possibly would have meant, or what I think most people think Easter is about. The first thing I thought was, it's probably, you know, Easter is about getting, like, Easter candy and, like, chocolates and stuff like that. And that fake plastic grass, which, you know, is nice, and everyone loves that. If that was what Easter was about, it would actually be kind of sad. The second thing that I think, and this is a little more serious, a lot of people think all that Easter is about is, since Jesus died, and he rose and went to heaven, when I die, I'll rot, you know, I'll raise and go to heaven. Which on one hand is true, but on the other hand, it really cheapens the impact and what Easter really means for us. And the third thing I think people think about Easter, and you hear this a lot in your, you know, Time magazines and history channels, is that Easter is just a made-up story. You know, Jesus never really raised from the dead. They just made it up so that those Christians could feel good about themselves or something. Listen to the words that Paul, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians, has to say about the reality of Easter and the resurrection. "And if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation has been in vain, and your faith has been in vain. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins. If for this life only we have hoped in Christ," and that means, you know, if we don't really believe or the resurrection didn't really happen, if that's the case, we are of all people most to be pitied. The fact is, Easter, Jesus Christ being crucified, dead, buried in the ground, and raising again, it is the single most important event in the history of the world. And that's not like a... I firmly believe in the bottom of my heart, that's not like a Christian overstatement. That is the fact. More lives have been transformed. The course of world history has been transformed when that man, Jesus, came out of the tomb on Easter morning. And if it's that important, if it means that much for us, we have to think about it. We have to know what it means, what it can do for our lives and for the world. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next few weeks. To do this, Christian set forth like a kind of plan to have Psalm 115 guide us through our talk about Easter. And in Psalm 115, there's it's kind of like an ancient cry of the Israelites to God. And it says, you know, God, if you're real, make yourself known. How come these nations, these people who aren't Israelites, who don't know you, how come they don't know you? And it goes on to say that these nations make these idols, and they make them out of, you know, stone and silver and gold and all these things. And this is what they worship. They worshiped these little things that were out of animals or what their interpretation of gods looked like. And then they say in the psalm, and this is in verse 3 of Psalm 115. You don't have to open it, but if you want to, you could. Our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak, eyes, but do not see. They have ears, but do not hear, noses, but do not smell. They have hands, but do not feel, feet, but do not walk. They make no sound in their throats. This is damning of idols. There's stories from the Old Testament about the prophet Elijah kind of like challenges a bunch of other prophets who worshipped idols to like a duel, basically. And he basically says, you know, if your idols are worth anything, pray to them and make them do something. And this happens over and over again, and they don't do anything. He prays to his God, and his God does something. So if our God is real, if he's alive still, you know, our God is in the heavens. If that's true, which we believe is true because the resurrection happened, it means that our God has a mouth, but he does speak. He has eyes, and he does see. He has ears, and he hears. He has a nose, and he smells. It's kind of funny. And tonight, I'm going to talk about this one. It says, they have hands, but do not feel. If there's one thing that I believe is true, it's that God has hands, and he feels our lives. He has the ability to reach into our lives and touch us and to change us. And that's what we're going to look at. To do this, we're going to look at the Gospel of Luke, because in it we have a story about Jesus, and I think it really hits this point as perfect as it can. And when we look at Jesus, who we see is God. So you can open up to page 839 in Luke. We're looking at verses 11 and on, under the title, Jesus Raises the Widow's Son at Nain. In this part of the Gospel of Luke, which, by the way, the Gospel of Luke is fantastic. If you have nothing to do tonight, which I'm sure you don't, go home and read the Gospel of Luke. It is really excellent. So the Gospel of Luke. At this point, Jesus has begun his ministry. He's kind of walking around Galilee, which is where he lived. He's teaching people how to live. He's preaching. He's telling them who he is, what the kingdom of God is all about. He's performing these miracles. He is healing people with withered hands, and he's telling these crazy parables. Just before this story, he heals the child of a centurion, which is a kind of like an army guy. So verse 11 of Luke 7. Soon afterwards, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went with him. As he approached the gate of the town, a man who had died was being carried out. He was his mother's only son, and she was a widow. And with her was a large crowd from the town. So here's the scene. You have Jesus and his 12 disciples, and then you have this large crowd who had been following him around, coming to this town called Nain. And this crowd who had been following him around, it's sort of unclear who exactly is in this crowd, but if you look back in, I think, chapter 6, it says that these were people from all over Galilee, all over Judea, from Tyre and Sidon, which are way up north. People from all over the place have been following him around. And it says that they're following him because they want to hear his teaching, and they want to see his miracles, and see his healings, and get healed themselves. So you have that crowd. As they come to the gate of the town of Nain, you have another crowd. And it's being led by a dead man in a coffin, being carried by a bunch of the guys who hold the coffin. Pallbearers, yeah, thank you. And there's a widow there who's, she was the mother of the boy who died. She had lost her husband some time ago. It doesn't say how long. And the son had just died. And there was this crowd of people who were with her. And they're two large crowds. And it's interesting because back in the first century, when someone died, they would actually hire professional mourners to go along with her. So it's not quite as if she was surrounded by this great group of people who were loving her and taking care of her. I mean, she was probably all alone in this. Her family was gone. She was all by herself. So you had this interesting contrast that Luke sets up between this, you know, this crowd, this parade of life, expecting miracles and healings and this wonderful teaching. And then you have this parade of death, expecting a funeral, expecting to bury the last hope of a woman. And then they were going to go home. For a woman in the first century, and sorry ladies that this is true, but for a woman in the first century to not have a husband or a son, she was just hopeless. She had no means to make money. Except from possibly becoming a prostitute. She didn't really have any social status. There weren't many jobs that she could get. So this woman, she's not just a widow who had lost her son. She's someone who she had lost everything at that point. If she can't make money, she can't pay taxes. So if she had a house, that was going to get taken away. And she probably couldn't afford rent. She might not be able to eat anymore. This is a dismal scene for this woman. And Luke here, I think, paints this picture so that his readers in the first century would clearly see. This is a picture of the lost, you know, of someone who is just hopeless beyond anything else. Someone who was totally alone, someone who had just lost probably the thing that meant the most to her, who really had no future. And if there was a future, she had no idea what it was going to be. As I was thinking about this story, it occurred to me that I think Luke also writes this story, paints a picture of this woman, so that people today would be put into her shoes. I mean, it really doesn't take much imagination for some of us to be put into these shoes. Some would be easier than others. I was talking to a guy the other day who was a friend of mine, and he was talking about what his life is all about and how the joy in his life and the possibility of the joy had just totally ran out. He was working at a job he didn't really like that got him nowhere. The situations that were kind of dominating the way he did things made it so that he couldn't possibly do things to even bring himself joy. He had really no hope of any future that was meaningful in any way. And it was, as I was listening to him talk, it was sad. I mean, it was really sad. It made me really think about this woman here. You know, this woman is a first century woman who has nothing. She has nowhere to go. But this isn't too far off from where a lot of us are in our own lives. And if we haven't felt this way, I hate to say it, but I'm sure at some point we will. And if nothing else, I know that we all know people who are in this place. But if the resurrection is true, if Easter is true, and if God does feel, well, how does God feel? When we look to verse 13, it says, when the Lord saw her, he had compassion for her and said to her, do not weep. Then he came forward and touched the bier, which was sort of the coffin, and the bearers stood still. And he said, young man, I say to you, rise. The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. This picture, I think, is amazing. If nothing else, don't you wonder what the man said when he stood up out of death? Like you'd figure that they would record that, you know? But I guess not. Luke actually always has a tendency to, say that something happened, but then never explain it. And you just kind of get really frustrated. But there's really a million things in those two sentences or two verses that I'd like to talk about, but I'm going to really talk about two of them. The first is going to be what happens when Jesus touches something, when he feels. And the second is going to be how and why does Jesus touch? Why does he feel? The first, we said in Psalm 115 that these false idols have hands but do not feel. They don't hear. But here, our God, who is alive, who is just as alive today as he was when this story was written. Our God in Jesus Christ has a hand that he reaches out and touches the coffin, and it stops. And he commands the man, this dead man, he commands him to rise. If there was one word to sum up the gospel, that's it. Rise. This is good news for any of us who feel like we are in the position of that widow. This is good news for any of us who feel like maybe we're closer to the guy in the coffin than we are to the widow. This is good news to this world who too often is on a track towards death, being carried there against its own will sometimes. It is good that when Jesus touches things, he transforms them. They turn from dead to living. Or they turn from being lost to being found. They turn from being sick to being healed. This is our God, and because Jesus is alive, because He is really with us, He has the power to do this, and He does this every day. This is good news. There's no place we can go. There's no depth we could sink to. There's no sin we can commit. There's no relationship we can be in that's so wrought with disaster that it's going to eat us alive. There's no state of hopelessness that God can't ever reach us in. This is good news. Not even death itself can contain the possibility of life. In the words of John, he says, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through Him. And that's just the fact. You can read the Gospels and you can read the book of Acts through and through, and over and over and over again, you see these pictures of Jesus touching things and things coming to life, of women rubbing their hand up against His cloak and they're restored, of bringing dead people back to life. This is our God. This is our risen God, Jesus. The second point is, how and why does He feel? I don't think it's enough. It would be enough, actually, if Jesus touched things and they came to life, and that was great. But there's something more to be said about this. And it comes in verse 13. There's one word in there. It says, when He saw her, He had compassion for her. That word compassion, I'm sure that some of you young adults have heard Christian talk about before. It's that weird Greek word. Does anyone remember it? Splunkizomai. Right. It's this weird word in Greek that basically it means something more than what the English says it does. The English says, where are we? The English said, He had compassion for her, which is nice, but what the Greek really meant was to feel compassion, to feel mercy. It comes from a Greek word that actually means bowels, like the guts and the black stuff that is inside of all of us. In the New Testament time, it literally meant something like the very insides of someone, the very heart of a person. So I think a better translation of this might be, when the Lord saw her, from the very bowels and from the depths of who He is, from His very heart, from the very being and heart of God, came forth compassion for her. If there's nothing else that you've heard me say tonight, this is what I want you to hear. Jesus Christ, our God, who has been raised from the dead, who has overcome death and sin for our sake and for the sake of the world, His very being, His nature, is compassion. His very bowels move when He sees us in misery. Or like in the parable of the Good Samaritan, when He sees the man on the side of the road left for dead, it was His compassion that made Him go to him and take care of him. Or in the parable of the prodigal son, it was the father's compassion for his son that he ran out and welcomed his son home. This is the God who we have. This is our God, and this is the God of the world. It is this compassion for the hopeless widows, for the poorest of the poor, and for the sick, for the alone. These are the sorts of people who Jesus came for. This is who His compassion is towards. This is who Jesus was sent to not condemn, but to save. So as we move on to verse 16, it says, "Fear seized all of them, and they glorified God, saying, 'A great prophet has risen among us, and God has looked favorably on his people.'" This word about him spread throughout Judea and all the surrounding country. We have this crowd of people, this parade of life following Jesus, going into this town where there's a clash with this crowd of funeral mourners, this parade of death. And we have Jesus raising this young man to life, restoring his own life, but more importantly, restoring the future of this widow who had lost everything. And then we have a subtle, Luke does something very subtle. It says, fear seized all of them. All of a sudden, there's not two groups anymore. There's just one. There's not a crowd of life and a crowd of death. They all feared God and praised him. They glorified him. It's just true. And I think for me, I can look at my own life and see this to be true. But I can also look at the lives of so many of the high school kids who I've worked with and for friends who have come to know Christ. It's just true that when you see his mighty works, when you experience them for yourself, or when you hear them proclaimed, God transforms death into life. This crowd of death, it passes away into a crowd of life, praising God. And this is really the second reason why Easter is so important. The first is that Jesus is alive and he's with us and he has compassion for us and he loves us and it's wonderful. But the second reason that Easter is so important, which this story bears witness to, is that we've got work to do. We're not just people who believe in Jesus and we put the check in the checkbox and we're going to heaven someday. That might be the case, but that isn't the case. The Gospels and Acts over and over again, they say that he wants us to go out into this world and do work for him. He says to go out into this world and make disciples, to go out and get people from the roads and bring them in. Jesus says that as the Father has sent me, so I send you. He says, you shall be my witnesses to the ends of the earth. The story of the widow at Nain says something so definite about what we are supposed to be and do in this world. And that goes for each and every one of us, if you are a Christian as an individual. And it also says something very definite to this community at Outreach Red Bank. In life, right now, there is a parade of death going on, unfortunately. I would say most of this world expects things to go wrong, has no future or has no hope. I think, unfortunately, we see this. I'm a high school leader, and too often I see this in the high school kids. Expressions of no hope and the uselessness of life. I think too often we give into this in ourselves, you know? Often we don't think that it's in us to ever have a future, to ever do anything real in this world. Often we give up on our relationships that are meaningful because they're doomed and we don't have the strength to go through with them. But then there's also a parade of life. It's following Jesus. It's waiting to see and experience exactly what he's going to do next. It's expecting miracles. It's expecting the dead to be raised. It's expecting the lost to be found. It's expecting those who have no hope to find hope in Jesus. And the question that I think we need to answer as a community, and you need to answer individually, is what crowd are you going to be a part of? What parade are we a part of? A great 20th century theologian named Leslie Newbegin was once asked, if he was an optimist or a pessimist. And his answer was, I am neither an optimist nor a pessimist. Jesus Christ is raised from the dead. In this life, it's not like for us to be optimists is just inaccurate. There's no room for optimism. Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead. He's promised to redeem this earth, to redeem our lives, to redeem the lives of our family members, of our enemies, of those kids who wanted to buy cigarettes, of the kids who wander into the high school group and just don't know anything. He's promised to redeem the lives of our coworkers who are just lost or hopeless. And this is what we go into the world with. We have to be part of the parade of life. We have to expect life. We have to expect dead people to come to life. I guess the challenge that I want to issue to everyone in here, whoever you are, whatever part of life you're in, for one thing, expect life for yourself. Expect resurrection. Expect that the promises that God makes to his people will come true. Even if you don't have the strength or the courage, or if you don't have the life itself to see it, it is true, and believe that. And also, the challenge is to go to the people who we know. Go to those kids in the parking lot who are trying to buy cigarettes. Go to the kids at the lunchroom table who are jerks and you don't like them. You know, these are the people who God has sent his son to. And just as Jesus was sent, we are sent. And we are sent with compassion. We are sent to follow Jesus into the town, to go to the hopeless, to have compassion on them, to expect miracles. This is who we are. And I think we have to find a way to speak to the world just as Jesus spoke to that woman. We have to find a way to say to the hopeless, do not weep. I'm going to pray, and then we'll have communion.